From Soundprint and producer Richard Paul, this is Rocketing Ahead.
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon.
Why, indeed? Look at anything with the perspective of decades, and it can seem inevitable. How often do we ever stop, look at the things around us, and ask, how did it get that way?
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Is that really the answer? Is that why America spent billions in outer space?
Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
What about the rest of it? The need to know what our enemies were up to. The need to stay ahead in an existential battle for nuclear superiority. Isn't that a part? Isn't that why we went there? How did we take that next step of deciding to go to the moon?
We set sail on this new sea because there is new knowledge to be gained and new rights to be won.
What were the forces, social, political, domestic, international, that shaped our decision to put a man on the moon? Scientific fact may be fixed, but every student learns that science reflects its history and is an ongoing, changing enterprise. So while science can change history...
Today, a new moon is in the sky, a 23-inch metal sphere placed in orbit by a Russian rocket. Here, an artist's conception...
With as much force, history can change science.
The Arctic, which has kept its icy secrets for centuries, is yielding at last to the scientific assaults of man.
So how did we come to where we are today in space? Why did we go to the moon? Much of what we now see around us began to take shape during the middle of what came to be called the American Century.
This was more than a routine bombing. It was the funeral pyre of an aggressor nation.
During World War II, science and technology brought horror and devastation, but they also brought the war to its end and ushered in life-altering changes that we take for granted. Things like jet engines, radio astronomy, radar, satellites, and missiles. The U.S. had come through the war virtually untouched. When it was over, American leaders, both policymakers and leaders in business, industry, and higher education, were able to pick up whichever of these advances they wished and do with them whatever they wanted. The decisions they made about what direction American science and technology would take still resound today. They help explain the vast intrusions of politics into modern American science.
This will be a national hearing instead of a partisan hearing. We want to know why Russia has two satellites, why we have none.
It explains the scrutiny of science by federal agencies and by Congress.
We would still require the engineers to completely put this material together in order to launch the satellite.
You say we can do it now. Would you want to say that you would have to discuss our military actualities if we can do it now? Would you want to rephrase your answer?
And they help us understand why the bulk of scientists and engineers in the United States do the kind of work that they do.
At Cape Canaveral, an Atlas ICBM lifts off the ground in a full-range test, the latest for this mightiest in the United States missile arsenal.
Today, of course, we see all this as inexorable. In fact, it was anything but.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. 3 days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office.
On January 17, 1961, President Dwight Eisenhower said goodbye. If you ask most Americans to name anything they remember from a presidential farewell address, at best you'll get two answers: George Washington's warning against foreign entanglements and a line from this speech, where Eisenhower poured out his frustration about forces that he said were hijacking the federal purse.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
In this speech, the president lamented the direction the country was headed when it came to spending money for science and technology. Of science, he said,
a steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists.
University research, the president said, had been removed from its lofty perch and was now a tool of politicians and the defense industry.
The free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research.
At the time of this speech, Eisenhower's vice president had just been defeated, and a Democrat, John F. Kennedy, was headed into the White House. According to American University space historian Howard McCurdy, that's what this speech was really about.
We all thought it was a warning about defense contractors, but in fact, I think what it was a bitter response to what had happened to the Republicans in the 1960 election.
Over the previous months, from 1957 until the election, the Democrats had pounded Eisenhower, particularly when it came to spending on outer space, and by a narrow margin, driven the Republicans and the Republican agenda from power. But we're starting at the end. Let's jump back.
You must have protection from radioactive fallout.
Survival offers maximum protection from fallout and falling debris.
There's low initial cost and FHA approval. Nothing down in 5 years to pay.
For your family's protection, see a Survival shelter today.
Keep in mind that science reflects its history. So, according to American University's Howard McCurdy, it's important to have a full recollection of the American state of mind during the Eisenhower years.
It was a very scary time.
In Moscow's Trade Union House, the father of Francis W. Powers is present for the elaborately staged spy trial of the U-2 pilot. He is the central figure in a courtroom drama whose red-written script is intended to indict the policies of the United States.
Public opinion polls suggested that 50% of the American public thought that we'd have a nuclear war.
Americans had at first largely embraced the atomic bomb. 85% supported the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And according to Paul Boyer, author of the book By the Bomb's Early Light, that attitude continued to prevail at the opening of the Cold War.
In November 1951, the Gallup poll found that 51% of Americans were urging the use of the atomic bomb in Korea.
But as the 1950s progressed, a creeping dread began to hijack the American psyche.
At the Yucca Flats Proving Grounds in Nevada, a plastic balloon carries aloft the largest atom bomb ever to be tested in the United States.
Alan Winkler is a professor at Miami University in Ohio and author of Life Under a Cloud, American Anxiety About the Atom.
In 1952, after a test basically carved out a huge mile-long hole in the bottom of the ocean, people began to realize that the hydrogen bomb was something that was pretty ominous and pretty awesome.
At United Nations headquarters in New York, the General Assembly meets in fateful session. Members of the Soviet delegation sit stony-faced as the story of Russia's ruthless suppression of Hungary is spread out for all the world to see.
What made matters worse from a U.S. perspective was that these bombs, which had once been ours alone, were now finding their way into enemy hands.
This is Boris Karloff. No one can guarantee the survival of every home during a nuclear war, but a strong civil defense can save millions of lives.
On top of all the generalized fear, in the mid-1950s, Howard McCurdy says the events that had plunged America into World War II were still fresh in everyone's mind, especially the president's.
He was a military officer who was raised with a generation of military officers for whom the events at Pearl Harbor had been seared into their consciousness.
Eisenhower, he said, would do anything to avoid a sneak attack. The president thought his best bet was to put eyes in the sky. The U.S. had spy planes.
As the plane gains altitude, the Earth becomes a map in color, a great flat plain broken occasionally by cities and rivers and mountains.
But according to Roger Lanius, a curator at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, spy planes were risky and controversial.
Every time you fly over a foreign nation, you have invaded their airspace, and they have the right to bring you down.
At a summit in Geneva with his Soviet counterpart, Eisenhower proposed an idea.
That we will open our skies to your overflights if you will open them to our overflights.
President Eisenhower renews his open sky plan to prevent surprise attack with a striking demonstration of aerial photography's effectiveness.
Here I want to show you a picture.
This is a photograph of the North Island Naval Air Station in San Diego, California.
At practically the same time of the Geneva summit, scientists and the National Security Council in the White House were meeting and approving a satellite program for the United States.
The U.S. and the Soviets had agreed that while a spy plane might be considered hostile, that same restriction didn't apply to something outside the atmosphere. Something, Roger Lanius says, like a satellite.
The key to satellite reconnaissance was that the stricture against overflying a foreign nation did not exist.
So when he was presented with a proposal for a satellite launch, it was advantageous to the White House to begin with a scientific satellite rather than to begin with a reconnaissance satellite.
A scientific satellite? Nothing like that existed. If one was made by the government, the Soviets would say it was just a weapon in disguise. Who would make it? Under whose auspices? The answer came from the world's scientists.
Feeling cold? Perhaps it's because the Antarctic has been in the news all the year.
A few years earlier, in 1950, some of the leading lights of America's scientific community got together at the home of James Van Allen, a top geophysicist. There, they talked about something called IPY, the International Polar Year, that sent expeditions to the North Pole in 1857 and 1858. There was a second IPY 50 years later. The scientists thought that 1957 and 58 would be a good time to do it all again. But this time, Roger Lanius says, they'd take the exploration even farther.
It's not just going to be about the poles. Let's make it geophysical. So it became the International Geophysical Year.
IGY, Lanius says, would be an exploration of a broad range of science.
Things like weather patterns. How do they work? How does the jet stream operate? What about the magnetosphere that had been theorized as something that existed above the Earth? Does it exist? What about the South Pole? Can we create bases that are scientific installations in these various places?
From the very beginning, it was decided that one goal of IGY would be to put man-made satellites into orbit. Up to this point, according to Robert Smith, a space historian at the University of Alberta in Canada, there were limited means of doing a lot of the atmospheric research that IGY wanted to accomplish.
There have been a lot of observations using earlier technologies, the balloons, and even things called rockoons, where you have a combination of a balloon and a rocket to try and extend your observation time.
U.S. Army doctor Major Simons became the highest man in the world by spending a whole day more than 19 miles up in a balloon gondola.
But it was really the satellites that gave you this extended period of observation from above the atmosphere.
The giant rockets that will launch Earth's first artificial moon are already in production as the International Geophysical Year opens.
President Eisenhower's need for surveillance dovetailed perfectly with IGY.
From the forbidding frontier of the Arctic ice cap at the top of the world come rare films made by a task force of Army engineers.
The IGY was an international endeavor. 63 countries ended up participating. It was the perfect opportunity to put a civilian, scientific American satellite into orbit.
The nuclear subs Fargo probes out of the Arctic ice pack to the poles. Her sail or conning tower pokes through at the North Pole itself. Latitude zero, longitude zero.
Bill Leslie is a professor of the history of science and technology at Johns Hopkins University. He says of IGY,
it's the public face of a lot of science that's being done in the black or classified.
He points out that the Pentagon supported the funding for the IGY because they saw the military benefit of the science it would achieve.
Much of what was going on was, okay, how do we map the gravitational field of the Earth, not just so we can understand it, but so that we can plot missile trajectories appropriately? Why do we send up satellites? Well, yes, they're useful for measuring the weather, but they're also useful for plotting our nuclear strategies.
The IGY started in July of 1957. All 63 countries involved were committed to making scientific advances, like putting satellites into space. So it's hard to argue that what happened 3 months later, on October 4th, was a complete surprise. The International Geophysical Year, IGY, began in July of 1957 with 63 countries pledged to explore the Earth's physical properties through human expedition and through emerging science. many of the participating nations had pledged to put a man-made satellite into orbit. So, despite what you've been told over the years, what happened 3 months later, this announcement over Radio Moscow on October 4th, 1957, was not a surprise.
As a result of intensive work by research institutes and designing bureaus, the first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created.
There are two different stories of the impact of Sputnik, according to Margaret Weidekamp, a curator in the Space History Division at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum.
One is the story that I think many of us have come to know, which is it was a great shock. And I think the shock really comes from the people who were working in the military complex or people who were working in rocketry or in satellites.
People like Gil Moore, who in 1957 was a graduate student doing IGY-related work at the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico.
My wife and I walked out on our front lawn and looked up, and we were stunned by this sight going across the sky. We thought, oh, if they can do that, they can throw nuclear devices at anybody they want to anywhere in the world.
But that attitude was not widely shared. The leader of the American satellite effort, UCLA physicist Joseph Kaplan, called Sputnik fantastic. Much of the public felt that way too. According to the Smithsonian's Margaret Weidekamp, the anthropologist Margaret Mead had a study in the field of high school and college students the night that Sputnik went up.
So they did an emergency telegram to all of their researchers asking them to get reaction in that first 7 days after the Sputnik. Were people afraid? What did people know about the satellite? What did people think the satellite could do?
She says they found quite a mix.
Some people very fearful, some people very hopeful, some people very excited. And there was a real mix of how important people thought this was.
Well, let's say the fun has just begun. We're on food deck number one. Outer space.
This is Jerry Engler and the Four Echoes singing Sputnik Satellite Girl. Engler wasn't the only one serenading Sputnik.
You see a lot of songs, popular music, R&B, swing, rock and roll, that adopt the beep, beep, beep into some of their lyrics.
There were country songs about Sputnik, blues songs. Louis Prima put a Sputnik song into his lounge act in Las Vegas.
My baby's fooling around with a satellite. Now you know that that ain't right. My love for her is gonna keep till she comes back and whispers.
And it wasn't just music. Paola Antonelli is a design curator at the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
Ashtrays to toasters to even cars were inspired, if not directly by the Sputnik, at least indirectly by the zeitgeist that it brought with it.
There was the Sputnik cocktail, two parts vodka, one part sour grapes. And the Smithsonian's Roger Lanius says,
you've even got a wrestler in Memphis, Tennessee, who changes his first name to Sputnik.
What this says about American reaction to Sputnik is significant. Talk of nuclear annihilation was everywhere, and yet here was a Russian satellite being celebrated playfully in American society.
With thousands of cheering kids on hand, alerted in advance to expect not Martians, not Russians, but Santa, traveling by Sputnik.
The Sputnik, you know what? It was the Soviet Union, it was fearsome, but it was all about advances, it was about progress, and therefore, it was safe to celebrate.
Sputnik, space helmets, and Santa. Ah, there's a jolly Christmas ahead for us all.
President Eisenhower's reaction was similar to the general public's, according to American University's Howard McCurdy.
Eisenhower was not surprised by the launch of Sputnik. It hit the press on Friday. Eisenhower left on Friday to go to Camp David to play golf.
When he got back on Monday, the president answered some Sputnik questions at a press conference.
Our scientists assure me that we are well ahead of the Soviets. We intend to stay ahead.
A few weeks later, when he had another press conference, Roger Lanius says,
nobody even asked about it anymore.
But that was about to change.
Now listen, Mr. Khrushchev, I heard a lot of talk about the satellite and missile and the president's fault.
The information already available to us indicates very clearly that our present target dates are entirely too modest.
The strategy to get America concerned and excited about Sputnik evolved through typical Washington back channels. An aide to Senator Lyndon Johnson named George Reedy got a visit from a friend named Charles Bruton. Here's Boston University historian Bruce Shulman.
Charles Bruton had been an assistant to Alabama Senator Lister Hill, who had seen federal investment in the region as a way out of the South's problems. And Bruton passed a memo to George Reedy, one of LBJ's closest aides.
Reedy talked about the impact of Sputnik in a NASA video in 1999, just before he died.
He came down to see me. And what he said was that this could clobber the Republicans and he could elect Lyndon Johnson president. Well, I told him that Lyndon Johnson wasn't interested in running for the presidency, and he said that was all right with him. He'd settle for clobbering the Republicans.
Reedy sat up most of the night composing a memo to Johnson on how to exploit the Sputnik issue. As Bruce Shulman says,
they understood that this was going to be big.
This could be one of the great dividing lines in American and world history, the whole history of humanity.
Republicans and Democrats had been battling over the best way to address the Soviet threat. Eisenhower preferred nuclear deterrence, mutually assured destruction. According to Mina Bose, a scholar of the American presidency at Hofstra University, the Democrats leaned on a strategy called flexible response that called for a range of options. She says that the Democrats argued
the Eisenhower administration, by cutting defense expenditures, relying more on nuclear deterrence and less on conventional forces, had made the United States more vulnerable.
Reedy told Johnson that the Democrats' key to success was to pound away at Sputnik and support more money for space science. The Smithsonian's Roger Lanius says Johnson picked up the ball and ran with it.
It's impossible to underestimate the importance of Lyndon Johnson. Nobody was more significant than him.
We're lagging in both the satellite and missile field. But there's no reason to believe that we cannot catch up if we have the will to win and if we just pitch in and get going.
In 1957, Johnson was about to begin an aggressive pursuit of the White House, despite what George Reedy told his friend Bruton.
The only major threat to Kennedy's hopes among the declared candidates is Senate Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson.
I think I can agree with everything that every candidate has said, except that conclusion they all draw, that they ought to be nominated.
As a frontrunner for the Democratic nomination, Johnson used Sputnik as a campaign issue against the Republicans. He said the Russian launch proved that the U.S. had squandered its lead in the Cold War. Meanwhile, President Eisenhower continued to believe that a space race with the Soviets would be expensive and counterproductive.
I don't believe we should pay 1 cent for defense more than we have to. But I do say this, our defense is not only strong, it is awesome, and it is respected elsewhere.
But Eisenhower didn't press the point, and he didn't bring it up that much in public. According to Roger Lanius, the president didn't see what his political enemies were plotting. Eisenhower, he says,
had a tin ear when it came to how this could be used against him.
Our nation has today, and has had for some years, enough power in its strategic retaliatory forces to bring near annihilation to the war-making capabilities of any country.
It is not very reassuring to be told that next year we'll put a better satellite into the air. Perhaps it will even have chrome trim and automatic windshield wipers.
Why didn't Eisenhower push back more effectively? According to Hofstra University's Mina Bose,
he didn't see that as an issue that really had to be addressed. He knew from secret U-2 flights, spy flights over the Soviet Union, that, in fact, the United States was far ahead of the Soviet Union in missile development and technologies.
Contrary to what Johnson and the Democrats were saying, throughout the 1950s, the U.S. was involved in extensive defense-related activity high above the atmosphere.
Final adjustments are made on the Atlas carrier and its payload, the 5,000-pound experimental Midas.
The U.S. had spent billions on rockets and missiles and was geared up to spend more. German scientists who'd surrendered to America after World War II had brought their advanced rocket technology with them and were now putting it to work on the American side in the Cold War. Konrad Dannenberg was the last surviving member of the German team before he died in 2009.
Colonel Tolstoy had also shipped over to this country 100 sets of V-2s. So the very first thing we did in this country was to build a test stand. And I'm still amazed, in the matter of just a few months, they could build, under wartime conditions, a test stand.
And American University's Howard McCurdy says the Defense Department was working to put humans on top of those rockets in a project called Man in Space Soonest.
The Air Force was ready to undertake a crash program to put a human in orbit. And they picked an astronaut corps, and Neil Armstrong was in that particular astronaut corps.
President Eisenhower reassures the nation that Russia's success with the first satellite does not indicate a serious lag in American rocket research.
Our satellite program has never been conducted as a race with other nations. Rather, it has been carefully scheduled as part of the scientific work of the International Geophysical Year.
In a way, Eisenhower had to keep quiet. He didn't want to tip off the Soviets about what he knew and how he knew it. But Mina Bose, who's written a book about the way Eisenhower communicated, says there's more to it than that.
He had a very limited view of how a president should use public communications. He really didn't see that as a tool for what presidential scholars would call building political capital.
I don't take it very kindly that the implied accusation that I'm dealing with the whole matter of defense on a partisan basis.
I don't think it's that Eisenhower was unable to do this. It was that he didn't really see that it was necessary.
And for a while in 1957, the president held steady. But American University's Howard McCurdy says world events were about to push things over to Johnson's advantage.
You've got to distinguish between Sputnik 1 and Sputnik 2. Sputnik 2 was launched with a dog and a payload, which if it had been translated into a warhead, was capable of delivering a warhead of sufficient magnitude to cause considerable damage to the United States.
Earth's first real space pioneer was a dog, a Russian husky called Laika.
It took the Soviets 4 years to catch up with the atomic bomb. It took the Soviets 9 months to catch up with the hydrogen bomb. And now, tonight, we're trying to calculate how long it will take us to catch up with the Soviet satellite.
America's first attempt to launch a satellite, a 6.5-inch sphere weighing just over 3 pounds, was checked out by scientists and declared ready.
Sputnik 2 would not be the end of America's problems. A month later, on December 6th, with a national television audience watching, the Navy finally prepared to put Project Vanguard into space.
What happened is already unhappy history. Another setback for the United States in the race into outer space. Here are official Defense Department films of the launching of the 72-foot missile.
The Vanguard missile exploded on the launch pad.
It looks like the Soviets can do no wrong and the Americans can do nothing right in space.
The strangest looking objects I ever saw from space, with a dog inside that got to ride into the USA to see our hound dog or American groundhog. That Russian canine can't stand the pace.
At this point, the Democrats ratcheted up the pressure. Here's former Johnson aide George Reedy.
And what Senator Russell did was to authorize Johnson to use the Senate Preparedness Subcommittee to hold some hearings into this whole question and start gathering people that could be useful.
One of the witnesses on yesterday compared the present situation to the challenge that faced America after Pearl Harbor. In some respects, I think it is an even greater challenge.
Our scientists have admitted that we're 5 years behind. And if that's true, I'm telling you this hiding place is mine. Don't care if it's roomy, just so it's roomy. And so it's somewhere Sputnik can find. Sputnik.
As often happens in Washington, interest groups coalesced around the two sides of this argument. On Eisenhower's side, the Smithsonian's Margaret Weidekamp says you had fiscal conservatives like Defense Secretary Engine Charlie Wilson.
And one of the things that he worried about was that exploration into human spaceflight would really look like Buck Rogers nonsense.
The groups on the other side, Roger Lanius says, were numerous. One were space enthusiasts who believed spaceflight was mankind's destiny.
A person like Wernher von Braun was clearly in this latter camp. He had said so many times repeatedly.
Here to reveal a plan for a trip around the moon is the chief of the guided missile development at the United States Army's Redstone Arsenal, Dr. Wernher von Braun.
A voyage around the moon must be made in two phases.
Von Braun was the leader of the Army's team of German rocket scientists. Their advances in missile technology fired the imagination of Americans and made space travel seem less and less like science fiction, an idea von Braun was happy to promote in any venue. Speaking here to military officers,
a rocket ship taking off from the Earth's surface will then keep circling the Earth in an orbit outside of the atmosphere.
And here on a TV show produced by Walt Disney.
On the right side of this picture, you see a large wheel-shaped space station.
A third group are the people who are in the aerospace industry, who certainly view this as an opportunity that they hadn't had before.
Then there were also university-based scientists who, according to Bill Leslie, a professor of the history of science and technology at Johns Hopkins University, had been receiving millions in federal funding during the Second World War. Money for space, he says,
looked very attractive because the space program was gearing up just at the time when some of those defense contracts were starting to level off.
These groups came together over Johnson's hearings. Many testified. Others wrote op-eds, magazine articles, made television appearances, and warned of the dangers posed by Soviet control of space.
If Russia wins dominance of this completely new area, well, I think the consequences are fairly plain. Probable Soviet world domination.
While the politicians involved in the space debate had their agenda, many scientists did too. While there were scientists who thought manned spaceflight was too dangerous, others pushed strongly for a human spaceflight project on a massive scale. A project that today would fall under the rubric of what we call big science. Robert Smith is a space historian at the University of Alberta in Canada. He explains.
The term big science is usually meant to include extremely large-scale projects that engage armies of scientists and engineers. If you're talking about the paradigmatic kinds of big science, then we will be looking at research around a very large accelerator, perhaps, or an enormous telescope.
At the time of Sputnik, America had just come off its first foray into big science, the Manhattan Project.
After World War II, that becomes something of a model for people to look at. And so, for example, you start to see discussions of now, for example, a war on cancer. How do you tackle it? Well, maybe we employ these kinds of methods that we've seen employed, say, with the atomic bomb project.
I would like to hear testimony on that before deciding that we should have a Manhattan Project.
While often making significant scientific advances, an important aspect of big science projects is, in fact, their bigness and the technological and scientific prowess it conveys. After Sputnik 2 and the Vanguard explosion, America, including the defense and intelligence establishments, feared the nation would be seen as second best around the world. They saw that the Russians were willing to pay anything to maintain a propaganda itch.
There have been grumblings in Russia about the cost of the space program, but that is forgotten today as tens of thousands pour into Red Square to get a glimpse of their hero.
There was a deliberate search for large-scale science and engineering projects that could gain America prestige on the international stage. The CIA even came up with one to drill through the Earth's crust. This push for big science had ramifications that still reverberate 50 years later. We'll hear about that and about a scientific discovery that scrambled our understanding of humankind's place in the universe when we come back. This is Rocketing Ahead from Soundprint and producer Richard Paul.